Do you mind if I...
No, no problem at all.
Let me begin. So it's a great pleasure to welcome William Large, Will Large, from the University of Gloucestershire. He studied philosophy and ethics, and he's the author of at least three books that I know about, Ethics and the Ambiguity of Writing. It's a text on French writer Maurice Blanchot and philosopher Emmanuel Levinas. And he's, in that context, he's written one of the major English language introductions to Blanchot's thought with Ulrich Kaser, was it?
It is, yeah.
And
well, I could tell you stories about that.
Yeah, no, interesting. We were those
over a pint.
And a text on Heidegger's Being in Time. So he's also, I believe, the president of the British Society for Phenomenology.
Yeah, which is a sign of its terminal decline, I imagine.
No, I was going to say, it's one of the most important organisations for concert of philosophy in Britain. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Will, and the title of this talk, I believe, is Remembering the Impossible Possibilities. Kierkegaard and Human Possibilities.
That's it, thank you. Thanks for that. So what I'm going to do, I've given Michael a copy of this paper, which you're freely available to have. So you can circulate it to anybody. So I'm not actually going to read this paper. There's two reasons for that. One is it wasn't written to be read. And so the second reason follows from that I find when people read out things that were not written to be read, I can't understand a word they're going on about because it's too complex. So having read this out to myself, thinking, I don't even understand what I'm saying, possibly that you won't understand. So I'm going to speak to it. So there are a few things I might have to read out just because I can't actually remember what I was saying at the time. But most of it I'm just going to talk to it. So what I'm going to do is just simply toe the argument and I'll see whether you're convinced by it or not. This hasn't been published as yet, which is why I can give you a copy of it. Publishers tend to be a bit worried about copyright. So any feedback would be very interesting. Now the gestation of this paper is a very long time ago. Like most things, once you get past 40, things could take much longer. In your 30s, you're full of energy, full of love and kindness.
I'm exhausted.
So Michael Burns, who was a PhD student of The Invisible Man at Dundee, I don't actually know what he did his PhD on.
Was
it on Kierkegaard?
Yeah. He's
going to
be the first contributor
to our
book series. Oh, great. Just got. And it's
on.
It's
kind of.
He's
very
influenced by G.J. Sweeney looking
for. Right.
It's called The
Fractured
Dialectic. And
he asked Kierkegaard
is a dialectic material.
Oh, right. So the opposite of you would expect. So Michael, I know Michael quite well. And if you ever met Michael, you'd like him. He drinks, for starters, that's always a good sign. And he's strangely obsessed by hip-hop. He's white, as well, so we all should have put into that. So he like most Americans, he's slightly ambitious. Us English people, we're diffident. But they're more ambitious than we are. That doesn't mean they're not wrapped with the same anxiety and self-loathing, it's just they don't display it in public, as we are ready to do. So he asked Lars Eyre, who's a friend of mine who works at Newcastle University, I mean, I would never imagine doing this, and I'm a PhD student. Mind you, it was much easier in my day. He'd already had this idea of having an edited collection on Kierkegaard, but he said he didn't want to. He didn't want, you know, academic essays on Kierkegaard. Not that he thought these were bad, just that he wanted to do something else. And he said, especially wanted a kind of mashup. I think that's the word the young people use. They wanted a mashup of like Kierkegaard and contemporary social theory. So in other words, the impetus of it didn't come from me, it came from outside. And it came from outside doubly because in fact, when I said we, he wasn't me, it was to Lars. Lars I then emailed me and said, do you want to do this paper together? We had this, we used to go to a lot of conferences together and increasingly we started hating them with an intensity that drove us to drink. You just used to sit there in rooms and people would just go on and on, drone on and on and on. None of it meant anything. On page 18 in Heidegger's Gesamtheitsgabe, he said this. On volume 18, he said that. And that contradicted what you're saying, what's the point of this? It's like philosophy had died. I don't know if any of your other older people in this room feel that, but anyway, that's what I feel. So we sat there and we thought, right, we've got to reinvent philosophy. So, not reinvent philosophy, but reinvent how we do philosophy anyway. So we came up with this idea called dogma, which we stole from Lars von Trier, which was that you should only write about things that matter to you. It should be utterly personal. There should be no footnotes, no proper names, and it should be full of plagiarism. So even if you only had one proper name like Kierkegaard, but you wanted to talk about Hegel, you couldn't use Hegel, you had to pretend you said it. And so it all had to be personal, and your aim was to drive people to weeping. So the other thing of it was that not only did it have to be personal and passionate, we decided we'd always do papers together. So if we were invited anywhere, either one of us, we'd stipulate we're only going to do this paper together. And always be a performance. Both our careers have ended in failure. So, So Lars wrote to me and said, Michael's asked me to write, you want to do this together? And I thought, why not? You know, sometimes you do the most interesting things when you follow an external voice rather than your own inner voice. Now, I've read Kierkegaard as an undergraduate at Essex University as part of the MA many years ago in the 80s. I did it with, I've forgotten his name. He's written a book, which I really like, his book on Kierkegaard. It's got a lot of passion in it, I thought. And I had known about Kierkegaard, but I hadn't really read him since then. So I then spent 2 years reading everything that Kierkegaard wrote. Now, I don't know if you've ever read any Kierkegaard. I see that some people have. I definitely know Alison has. Unless she's managed to... Kierkegaard is unbelievably difficult. Kierkegaard is like, on the surface, you might think, oh, well, he's a beautiful writer. But sometimes he's not actually a beautiful writer. Some of the things, what the hell is he saying? Fear and Trembling, you think that's beautifully written. But occasionally you think he could have done with an editor. So he's extremely difficult to understand, I think. And he's similar in that sense, I suppose, a bit like something like Nietzsche. You think on the surface this is beautiful and you just wade through it. And then somebody asks you, well, what is Nietzsche saying? You think, now it's much harder. So I spent 2 years reading all of Kierkegaard and discussing it with Lars, and this is what we came up with. So this is what I'm going to talk to you about today. I just want to say, so that's the gestation of it. I always think it's interesting to know why people write, how did it happen, how does it occur, all the Kierkegaardian points, of course. And the second thing, it seems strange to talk about Kierkegaard and not talk about yourself in some way, even though, as I'm going to say, you're not talking about yourself when you're talking about yourself, at least if you're doing it correctly. When you talk about yourself, really, you're not doing it right. I'll tell you how to do it.
Get on with the talk.
That is the talk, there isn't anything out there. But the other point is, I think that when it comes to talking about philosophers, when it comes to talking about politics, it really must have to do with ontology. That is, I'm not interested in making value judgments. And let alone being practical in any way whatsoever. I can't bear it when somebody says that to me. I don't think that's a job of philosophers to do that. So I think politics, when it comes to politics, it's ontology or nothing. That's what it's about. The second thing is that I think the key issue for us, the contemporary issue for us, is capital. And I'm particularly interested in the shift, which is like a recent shift, in the form of capital. That is, the centrality of human capital, or the subjectification of capital, which I think is central to the ontological understanding of capital, not the economic, the ontological understanding of capital. That is how capital affects our lives. Thirdly, I think academic philosophy is finished. Sorry, I don't have that one. Okay, so the clue to this, the reason why I could even agree to Lars's mad idea, and why I subjected myself to reading the whole Kierkegaard again, is at the time I was really obsessed with autonomism, which is a French, Italian philosophical movement that came out of the 68s. You know people like Negri is probably one of the famous people, you know, Agamben, all these people. There are other famous people as well. And I was very interested in, I spent a long time reading all their work, and one of the most interesting thinkers in that, I think, One of the things is, if you do the research for yourself and go back to the origins of a philosophical movement, what you discover is they're all plagiarizing each other. And when you thought somebody was being original, like Agamben, you realize actually he's just stolen everything. I don't know what that tells us about human ethics. Anyway, one of the interesting guys in that, I think the most interesting, is somebody who is actually well known, and in fact his work is not translated. There are a few essays occasionally translated, and that is Mario Tonti. And he's the Urvater. Yes, everything comes from him, I think. You know, all this discourse about subjectivity, capital, all this stuff you hear in autonomism, my belief, it all comes from him. Well, he wrote a late book, which is La Politica al Tramonto, Politics of the Twilight, something like that, which is a late book he wrote in the 1980s, which is a book of nostalgia, really, about showing how everything, we're all doomed. I kind of like reading those books, but really it's about the end of politics. Why has politics finished? Why is it over for us? I feel like we're living in zombie times. It just, everything gets repeated. So, you know, in 2008, the whole system collapses, but nothing changes. It doesn't make any difference. It just carry on in the same way. So it's a book in that kind of mood. But in that book, there was the following quotation. So I am going to read you to this. Sorry for the translation. My Italian, I know French well, so my translating from Italian is via French, so it might sound a bit strange. I sent this my translation to an Italian person, and he corrected it, but this is not the correct version. But there's enough meaning here. It was the greatness of Hegel, this is Tonti, to have told it like it was. On this basis, Marx is right to become aware of the laws of movement of capitalism. But to go beyond him, it was better to have started with Kierkegaard than Hegel. So why would it now be interesting to go back to read Kierkegaard? What is so pressing about reading? Why would somebody like Tonti think that in this historical period, in this transformation of the history of capitalism, why should we all go back to reading Kierkegaard? So I thought, I'm going to go back and read Kierkegaard and see what happens. I didn't have anything in mind before I did, but except this idea that Tonti's view that it was important. Okay, so that's why. Now, what I want to say is, why we need to read Kierkegaard and what this whole paper is about is at the heart of the concept of human capital, which is an economic concept, there is an ontological error. So it's not an economic critique or a political critique of economics I'm going to offer, it's an ontological one. And that's what I discovered in reading Kierkegaard. One important footnote here, I'm not interested in getting Kierkegaard right. Though that doesn't mean I am an academic, so I do like arguing about things like that, kind of trained philologically, so it's not that I don't get a lot of joy from it, but in the end, I'm not interested. It's not worth a scholarship. Not that I don't think scholarship is important, because how the hell could I read Kierkegaard in English translation if there were any scholars? But I myself am not particularly interested. In the same way, I don't think Kierkegaard was interested in getting Aristotle right. And it would be really strange to think that one was offering an interesting reading of Kierkegaard by correcting him on that matter. I've just got to turn my phone off, sorry. So, very briefly, my reading of Kierkegaard comes from Tronti. So the next thing I want to say to you, which I'm going to be very brief, is just briefly explain Tronti's most important work, which is Workers and Capital. And also I think this should be read by everyone. Anyone who's interested in autonomism anyway. This is the key book, I think. And every idea that is now famous through people like Negri or Agamben and all the other famous autonomists, to me, is there in that book. Strangely, it's never been translated. According to Howard Cagle, there is a manuscript hovering around somewhere in English, but nobody can get their hands onto it, and there's some kind of publisher's embargo on it. Publishers buy up translation rights. I think Verso has it or something. If you can read French, you can find this online in French. I'm assuming it's not legal though. Oh, you're taping this, aren't you? So that it's available in a French edition online if you can read French. Very briefly, his argument is that at the heart of capitalism, there's a struggle between the worker and capital. Now that's of course not novel, you won't find that in Marx, and even writers before Marx. What is interesting, I think, about Tronti's description, though, of this struggle, is that he wants to show that the model of a labour market that's put forward by classical economic theory describes the end of a process rather than the beginning. In the classical, you know, if you get a classical economy textbook, this is a simplification, but I think the simplification is the truth. The simple model is that an individual worker simply sells their expertise and skill to an individual capitalist. And this is supposed to be a transparent and rational exchange. So free individuals sell themselves, and in selling themselves they become objectified labour or salaried labour. Tronti argues that this model is an idealization, and the individuality upon which it's predicated on, an individual worker sells him or herself, is actually produced by that model. It's not a given. The worker, in other words, already has to understand themselves as an item of human capital and as such an investment for future earnings. I relate to myself as a commodity that has a certain value summed up by the level of salary I might earn. And Tronti's point is capital already has to produce, has to individualize the worker for this model to operate. This process of individualization we call the objectification of the subject. In place of the living human subject, part of a larger societal whole, capital produces a generalized subjectivity. Now, Tronti hoped in the 60s and 70s, and 68 lasted much longer in Italy, probably until about 75, than elsewhere did in Europe. Tronti hoped that the self-organization of those workers would be, in some sense, be able to save them from their mutilation by the monopoly of capital. And by resisting the objectification of subjectivity, they could change the nature of capitalism itself. Yet even in this work, Workers and Capital, Tronti has already had a premonition of how this political project would fail. That is, that capital will triumph when it individualizes the worker, makes the worker see themselves as an individual. And he already saw that that would be the end of politics. So already in 1966, this is why this book is so amazing, I think, it already has a premonition that the politics of revolution was coming to an end. And all there would be a management of capital. So does this mean then that resistance is futile? They simply just have to accept the status quo? I think what I would say really is that before we can create new collectivities, which Tronti was imagining in this work, we first of all have to save our subjectivity. That is, we have to win back our subjectivity from the generalized subjectivity of human capital. And this is where I think saving the subject from the domination of human capital, and I will explain in a minute what I mean by human capital, is where Kierkegaard, I think, where I understand Tronti's saying you've got to go back and read Kierkegaard. So I would say the objectification of the worker in human capital might be an ontic fact. I know that as a university teacher. My students see themselves as human capital or are increasingly forced to see themselves as human capital. That is, education is an investment on future earning. Why would you get in debt for £9,000 a year? Not because of your intrinsic love of Kierkegaard, but for some strange way, knowing or understanding fear and trembling would help you become a better manager in the future. You know, and you can go online and read people defending philosophy for that very reason. You know, philosophers made great commodity financial speculators like George Soros or somebody. So, I would say that's an ontic historical fact. People do see themselves as human capital, as cells whose only activity is a form of investment on future earnings. But such a historical fact is an ontological mistake. And that's what Kierkegaard, for me anyway, shows us. What is this ontological mistake? The ontological mistake is to reverse the relationship between potentiality and actuality. It is to determine the potential by the actual and not the actual by the potential. So one of my arguments is going to be is that at the heart of Kierkegaard's understanding of the subject, what I'm going to call the passionate self, is Aristotle's conception of movement. But a very, very weird and very strange understanding of Aristotle. If you do the scholarly research, which I kind of enjoy, I like scholarly research like because I feel it's like collecting stamps. So I really enjoy it. There's not much evidence that that Kierkegaard read Aristotle. He attended lectures, and a bit like Nietzsche, there is some evidence that he read some very famous primers on Aristotle's logic. So I don't think it's the case that Kierkegaard's offering a scholarly understanding of Aristotle. You know, so some people will write about it and say, well, clearly Kierkegaard didn't understand Aristotle. Actually, I think that in a particular understanding of Aristotle, he gets it quite close. But I don't really think that's what the issue is. Kierkegaard's doing something with Aristotle. And what it has to do with, I think, is rethinking the relationship between possibility and impossibility. Or, if you prefer, between potentiality and actuality. That's what we'll come to right at the end. So that's my gambit. I'm saying, well, you can understand Bonte because the historical change in the nature of capital has become increasingly subjective in form. It's about understanding yourself as capital. Yourself has now become capital. You are nothing but an investment on the future, on future possible earnings. I'm agreeing with Foucault in his lectures on biopolitics, which peculiarly have nothing to do with biopolitics, which is where he examines Austrian economic theory, which is the basis of the Chicago School, that there's a real conceptual shift in the understanding of capital, going from an objective to a subjective meaning. So if we are right about that, and Kierkegaard is a philosopher of subjectivity par excellence, maybe Tonti's right. Maybe Kierkegaard has something to say to us. But what he has to say to us, I think we have to be careful about. What he has nothing to say, which I think is a useless concept, is one. If I'm saying we ought to go back and look at Kierkegaard again, not for some clapped out, empty, banal idea of authenticity. I cannot bear it. I just think it's a complete waste of time. One of the reasons why I think it's a waste of time, A, I don't think it's in Kierkegaard anyway. You know, so I'm talking about, you know, Kierkegaard 101, you know, the great existentialist philosopher, that kind of level. I'm not sure it's in Kierkegaard in that way. But B, what is the highest expression of human capital now? It's authenticity. It's not enough now to simply work. It's not enough that I go and work in the student union bar. I have to demonstrate that I actually believe in it. I have to be authentic. It's not enough that I go in and do my job. Yeah, I have to actually make it appear that this job is my whole life. And nothing else, unto death. So I clearly don't think authenticity or being creative, all that stuff, what people tend to think about existence, being myself, that's not going to be a very useful way of thinking about human capital, because that's exactly what human capital demands of us. Be yourself, be an individual, be authentic, be creative. It's utterly expropriated the language of existentialism. Now, there's a little digression there into Adorno. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, and in fact I'm not even sure why I put it in, but you know, Adorno is one of the few philosophers who takes Kierkegaard's politics seriously, I think. Not in the way of simply just thinking about some of the reactionary things that Kierkegaard said, which I'm not interested in, and neither is he, but in that Adorno is, Kierkegaard is useful in thinking about capitalism. But as we know, Adorno, I think, has a very problematic relationship to Kierkegaard. His earliest PhD was on Kierkegaard, but actually he never really stopped writing about Kierkegaard all through his life. And so I think although he says certain things about Kierkegaard that might appear dismissive, oh, he's just a bourgeois philosopher, etc., etc., I don't really think he means that. So I'm not going to say a lot about Adorno because it's really not that much important to my argument here. The only thing I said is that I think, and it shouldn't surprise you, that at least in his PhD, that I think Adorno misunderstands Kierkegaard, because I think his approach is not sufficiently historical. I think that Adorno objectifies a certain historical form of capital and universalizes it. That is, there's no intimation in Adorno, at least not in his work on Kierkegaard, of the subjectification of capital. So that means that his critique of Kierkegaard as an individualist bourgeois philosopher whose philosophy is a result of the historical transformation of capital, a symptom of it, that for me doesn't really work. And that's because for me, I think he too quickly objectifies Kierkegaard. For him, the interior of the self is nothing but the intérieur. He's playing on the notion, even we have in English, of interior and interiors. He talks about furniture and Kierkegaard's apartment. He says, playing on that Kierkegaard's passionate self is a retreat from the world, and this retreat from the world is actually caused by the objective processes of capital. So it can't be in any way a solution to it. But I think the notion of inwardness, or what I'm going to call the passionate self in Kierkegaard, is not, and in fact I would say it's the very opposite, of the process of subjectification. The objective self of subjectification, what I'm called generalized subjectivity or objective subjectivity, is human capital. Now, as far as I know, there's no notion of human capital in Adorno, but I might be wrong about that. But again, I'm not that bothered by that. Now, having then spent many years reading Kierkegaard, I then spent, which is a happy time, if not a difficult time, I then spent a very long time reading everything about human capital. That wasn't so great. Human capital essentially has its origins in work that came out of economic theory in the 1940s in America. Its origin was probably theories of health and education. But after over many years, as Foucault himself describes in his lectures, it begins to actually become the very theoretical concept of capital, tout court. It becomes a generalized concept. Human capital, at the theoretical level, is the abolition of any distinction between the internal and the external. Economic theorists say it's a heterogeneous as opposed to homogeneous conception of capital. For in it, capital contains no other. As soon as economic theory develops the notion of human capital, there is at that point no outside to capital. Capital contains everything, that's why it's heterogeneous. Traditionally, capital was divided into fixed and variable capital, where the latter refers only to the power of labour. Everything that lay outside this relation, family, friendship, love, was outside capital. Human capital abolishes this difference. Every possible human relation becomes a relation of capital. And thus it's perfectly possible in a classic work of human capital called Investment in Human Capital, The Role of Education and Research, which came out in the 40s but was republished in 1970, it's perfectly possible to imagine the relationship between the child and the parent as a relation of capital. Foucault, when I read Foucault's lectures, he refers to this passage, though I read it beforehand, and he just refers it. Most of the time when Foucault refers to things, he doesn't let his moral and ethical sensibility emerge. It's always just glacial. It's just watching reality unfold. Don't judge it. At this point, even he is flabbergasted by the notion of child capital. Yes, I'll read this because it's so hilarious, but it gives you some sense of how human capital can be including all human, all relations within it. All relations, love, friendship, as they say, become a form of capital. Just think of it. I suppose Facebook is a good example. Even friendship. No. So, anyway, this is the quotation. A particular class of human capital consisting of child capital, even the person who writes this, Schultz, one of the most famous theorists, begins to a bit slightly wonder, so I've put child capital in quotation marks as though he's slightly embarrassed by the whole thing. A particular class of human capital consisting of child capital may hold the key to an economic theory of production. The formation of child capital by the household man and wife would begin with the bearing of children and proceed through their rearing through childhood. An investment approach to population growth is now breaking new ground. So why do you have children? Because they're an investment on future earnings. Why do I look after you? Why do I feed you and love you? Because I'm hoping that in the future you will earn more money than me and give me more money back. Because, you know, I'm wasting my time on you. You're an investment. Now, why do we want to resist that? Why do we think there's something insane about it? Why would we want to put a little bit more on that than just square quotes? Is really, I think, the important thing. Foucault, in his lectures on biopolitics, who referred to this passage, says, and if you want to ask me, this nebulous concept of biopolitics is just really about the history of human capital, transformation of capital from objective to subjective. So I would say biopolitics is nothing but the history and genesis of a concept of human capital. Foucault in his lectures goes on, and it's amazing that Foucault was doing this in the 70s. What a leap ahead. He goes on to explain, Foucault says, that at the heart of the concept of human capital is an entirely new concept of the value of work. Again, you as students in a university now in 2014, 2014, face the reality of what Foucault was only prophesying in 1970. The new concept of value of work, Foucault says, which is not to be found in Smith, Ricardo and Marx, is that work is no longer measured objectively, but subjectively. Work is no longer a limited question of an element within an objective economic process of production, but the very question of existence itself, and thus a matter of life and death. Human capital analyzes work not from the side of work is objectified, but from the viewpoint of the worker. I invest for the sake of future revenue. This is the general definition of capital. My salary is a future revenue of capital. In this case, the capital is myself. I go to university, this is a classical form of human capital, that is, I don't earn income because I can't work, but also I have to pay for it. Because why am I doing this? Because I hope in the future I will earn more money than the money I have lost in spending on my education. What became a specific theory about education, a minor school in the theory, becomes a generalized theory of human existence itself. All human existence is simply investment on future earnings. I am capital. So that means there's no longer a difference between life and capital. Everything becomes contained within the concept of capital. There's no outside. So Foucault says this is something, this is an historical shift. And so he says, this is the difference between the Marxist analysis and the neoliberal one. He's looking at the Austrian school. In the former Marxist, classic Marxist view, I am appropriated by capital. I'm alienated by capital. Whereas in the latter, I myself am capital. Therefore, by definition, I can't be appropriated. For Marx, the expression human capital is an oxymoron. For the new theorist of capital, it is the tautology. And this is the massive change. Society is nothing but the unity of such individual enterprises, so we're all to see ourselves now as entrepreneurs, self-entrepreneurs, just as bits of capital. Society is nothing but the unity of such individual enterprises whose smooth operation is the sole purpose and function of the state. As Marx puts it, Foucault puts it ironically in his lectures, that free market actually required massive, as you probably have gathered, massive state involvement. That is a paradox. So as I said, I don't think of trying to think of, so the key question for me is, how can we think about the self that would escape such an objectification? As I said at the beginning, not by returning to some worn out idea of authentic individuality, because I think the idea, the language of authentic individuality that one might find in existentialism has actually been totally appropriated by human capital. What I think we have to do is think about the subject in a different way. So it's not about authentic individuality. That is not what is at stake here. But what is more profound than any objectified subject? But what is more profound than any objectified subject, I want to call the possible. This is why Kierkegaard never tells us objectively what it means to be subjective. We must make a distinction between what the self is, its role and identity within society, and how the self is. In the first case, the self is an actual self. It is a self arrived at the end of a process. It is a self I have invested in through my education, training and health. But the self as a how is not a self in this sense at all. It is the self of the possible over and above the actual. The first self is ontic, the second ontological. Human capital never goes to the limit of the objectified interiority of the self, even though it is utterly parasitical on its abilities and capacities that exceed it. What matters in the rationally governed society of human capital is the partial actualization of possibilities, and never the pure possibilities of life that precede any actualization. This explains its fatalism and despair. So in other words, what I'm saying is the actualization of subjectivity through human capital is always a reduction, a subtraction. And what we have to, as philosophers or Kierkegaardians, is have to get back to what is being subtracted, which I am calling the pure possibilities of a life. Now, I think there are many examples, and I call that the pure possibilities of life, the passionate self. Like I am opposing the objectified self that takes its form in human capital, and the passionate self. I'm saying the first is ontic, and to be understood through the category, the modal category, actuality. The second, the passionate self is ontological, and to be understood as the modal category, possibility. My final claim right at the end, how long have I got, by the way?
10-15 minutes.
Bloody hell. Right. My final claim at the end is going to be that what is ontologically interesting, wow, that's a very English word, ontologically interesting, I mean a word stronger than interesting, ontologically amazing about Kierkegaard is he reverses the relationship between the actual and the possible, that the possible precedes the actual, that the possible isn't dependent on an actuality preceding it. That reversal of the relation between the that's because I can do that because I see the difference between possible and actual ontologically, not ontically, it's not about acorns and oak trees as people tend to explain that relationship. Is he can do that because of his way that he reads Aristotle. I actually think his reading of Aristotle is right, but because I read Aristotle in a certain way, there are some other commentators who think that he's wrong. But in the end, I will say that it's not in itself, that's not really important. It's whether there's something interesting about thinking about how we think about the passion itself. So the next part of the paper, which I have no time to read to you now, unless I read it at such a ridiculous pace it would be absurd, is the passion of thinking. What I want to say is there are many examples of the passion itself in Kierkegaard. So I need one example to think, well, how could we think of this relationship between the passion itself and the actualized self, the objectified self? And I think of it through the passion of thinking, and Kierkegaard uses a pseudonym. But as one example, there are many others. What I wanted to do there was simply say that Kierkegaard uses pseudonyms for a very important reason. They're not used because he wants to hide himself, because everybody knew he was writing this damn stuff. My view about the difference, the why he used them, was precisely to point out this gap between the actual and possible self, or the objectified and passionate self. And I look at certain very interesting passages in the Philosophical Fragments where he talks about how thought, thinking, exceeds the possibility of thought. So through that I try and show how we might understand how possibility, in an ontological rich sense, is greater than actuality. But since I have no time, I'm not going to say any more further about that. But again, you can have, if you want to, look, I can talk about it in the discussion, but also you can have a paper and you can look at that example if you want to see. So I'm going to jump to the crux of the matter, which is Kierkegaard's ontology, because that's the key to my argument. If that doesn't stand up, the whole thing falls down. First of all, I think Kierkegaard had an ontology. Let me be clear here. I don't think, if Kierkegaard was in this room, I think he'd find this whole thing hilarious, because I don't think Kierkegaard interested in the slightest bit of what I'm talking about. Kierkegaard was a philosopher of religion. What, to him, not even a philosopher, well, he's interested in religious life. I do think his notion of religious life has to do with the passion itself. But to get to there, of course, you have to do a lot of thinking. And, you know, and the idea that Kierkegaard is not a great thinker, excuse me, he had to think really hard. But in a certain sense, for him, what I might be obsessed by or find interest is for him something on the way. So I don't think for him this was, you know, the culmination of his life. This was what really mattered to him. For him, this is just like the foothills of the Himalayas. I'm just scrabbling around in his garbage. You know, if he's throwing away remarks. But I mean, he because of the way he thought about faith, he did have to come up with a new understanding of subjectivity. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I think Heidegger is utterly wrong about Kierkegaard when he says in Being and Time that he has no ontology. I think Heidegger is a liar, and actually some of his lies might make you think he is. Or he's simply wrong, because clearly Kierkegaard does have an ontology. And in fact, not only would I say that Kierkegaard has an ontology, I don't think you can understand Kierkegaard at all if you don't grasp his ontology. The irony, in relation to Heidegger's accusation, is Kierkegaard's ontology is a form of Aristotelianism. Because Being in Time is just a reworking of Aristotle. That's the irony. So, I would argue that Kierkegaard frames his rejection of Hegel as a return to Aristotle. Especially the latter's explanation of change and motion, kinesis. Now, subsequently of working all this out, I noticed that my thesis is very close to Claire Carlisle, who's somebody I know very well, and you should invite her to give you a paper here sometime if you want. Her PhD, Kierkegaard's Philosophy of Becoming, Movement and Position. So what I'm arguing here is what she puts forward in a much more scholarly way in her book. So it's nice to know that that we came to this idea separately but together. So Aristotle, just repeat that, Kierkegaard's ontology is a form of Aristotelianism. Now, kinesis, or change, or motion, or however you want to translate it, has become a kind of commonplace to us now, so that we have great difficulty in understanding what Aristotle's problem was in the first place. We think his solution, even if we no longer agree with it, because of developments in modern science, is obvious. Of course, you are an august group of people, so I'm talking to the herd, this sentence. You, of course, know that Aristotle's notion of kinesis is utterly, very, very profoundly puzzling. When you teach Aristotle to undergraduates, and you don't want to startle them with the sheer enormity of philosophy and the hell that there is contained in it, you might come across definitions that, for Aristotle, change, motion, kinesis, is the actualization of a potentiality. So, you know, I remember being told that you get an acorn, yes, you have an, I'm drawing the acorn, and it goes into the oak tree. Yes. So for the acorn, which has the potentiality of the oak tree within it, there must be something that actualizes that potential. The sun, water, whatever. And eventually we get back to some guy called God, who's the great big actualizer, who actualizes himself somehow, mysteriously, by just thinking. So that's the story of Aristotle that you get. But the problem with it is, if you say change is the actualization of potentiality, and that's what you think that Aristotle is saying, then all you are saying is change is change. I don't understand why you possibly are saying anything if you say that, if that's what you think that Aristotle is saying. Now, my interpretation of Aristotle is very influenced by a French reading of Aristotle by Pierre Albin, Le problème de l'être chez Aristote, problem of being in Aristotle, I think is the best thing ever written on Aristotle. My question. It's never been translated? No idea why it's never been translated. He shows you in Aristotle things you never thought were there. He completely changes the way you think about Aristotle. He's a bit controversial, and you can tell from his title, very influenced by Hardy. So this reading of Aristotle that I'm giving you is heavily influenced by him. And he's the one who says that cannot be the meaning of change in Aristotle, that it's just the actualization of a potentiality, because that's just a redundant tautology. So what does he say? He says, how can the same become other whilst remaining the same? This is the paradox that is at the heart of change. Socrates sitting and Socrates standing are both identical and not identical. This can only be the case because what is the same and what is different are not meant in the same way. If they are different, then there is no unity. If they are the same, then contraries exist at the same time. It would be a profound misunderstanding of Aristotle to think he just brings these contrary positions together. The difference between potentiality and actuality is the expression of the problem. So in other words, what one Albin convinces of is that what people think is the answer is actually the problem. To problematize something means to look at it in a different way and not to accept the solutions that I've given and have led to the impasse. The difference between potentiality and actuality means two things. There is a subject of change that is potentially what it will become, and contrary predicates exist potentially and not in actuality. It is a profound mistake, however, to think that what is first is the difference between potentiality and actuality. What is first is the ontology of being. So this is what's really important. It's not the difference between potentiality and actuality that explains being, which is the traditional way that people understand Aristotle. It's the other way around. It's being understood as change that explains the difference between potentiality and actuality. If we say that the division of potentiality and actuality is first, then we collapse the difference between change and potentiality and actuality so that these terms would have no explanatory power. So the key, again, I haven't got time to read you all this, the real key is, how then does Aristotle understand being? That is, how does he understand change? He understands change as the actuality, as potentiality, rather than the actualization of a potentiality. That's what that's supposed to mean. I spent a whole afternoon translating that. Do you want to hear my translation? It's strange that I got the entelechy and missed the N of it. The nun. Yeah. Change is the actuality of that which is potential as such. Now I want to claim what that means is, this means that change in itself is an actuality whose being is always potential. An imperfect actuality. It's because Aristotle understands being as an imperfect actuality that he can make sense of the difference between potentiality and actuality. And that is because he understands being as infinite. Or, here it's called imperfect. Imperfection means incompletion and explains the relationship between change and the infinite. The infinite is a potentiality that never finds completion in an actuality, or which is saying the same thing, an actuality whose being as actuality is always potential. So Aristotle, it's because Aristotle understands being as infinite, a potentiality that never reaches completion in actuality, or an actuality whose being is always potential, that being as change means that becoming other is a permanent actuality of being that is never accomplished. And it's this that explains the difference between potentiality and actuality, rather than potentiality and actuality, the meaning of change. So the shift is that it's the understanding of being as infinite or imperfection which explains change, understood as the difference between potentiality and actuality, and not the other way around. That's what Kierkegaard sees in Aristotle. That's what Auerbach explains Aristotle's ontology. What Kierkegaard does then is take this Aristotelian ontology, and this is in the Philosophical Fragments, some of the densest pages that Kierkegaard's ever written, takes this Aristotelian ontology and applies it to the subject. He subjectifies it. Change for Kierkegaard must be understood ontologically as coming into existence. There are two types of change: that which already exists and changes, and that which does not exist and comes into existence. The first type of change, things that already exist and change, Kierkegaard calls finite freedom and belongs to essence. And the second type of change, something that comes into existence, he calls infinite freedom and belongs to being or existence. Being itself is split into two, being and non-being. What is crucial for Kierkegaard is that non-being exists. And Kierkegaard underlines the strangeness of this, for non-being explains the difference between potentiality and actuality, and that's the similarity between him and Aristotle. Remember, it's being understood as imperfect that explains the difference, not the other way around. Kierkegaard writes, "This change," he writes, "is not in essence, but in being, and from not existing to existing. But this non-being that is abandoned by that which comes into existence must also exist. If the non-being did not exist, there would be no change. Non-being is the ontological basis of potentiality and being, actuality. Coming into existence, the change from non-being to being, is the difference between potentiality and actuality. The opposite, which is ontological for Kierkegaard, not logical. So these are modal categories of on-being, not modal categories of logical semantics. The opposite is necessity. Necessity cannot come into existence. Kierkegaard understands kinesis, change, motion, as freedom, or precisely as infinite freedom. But he does so only because he reverses the relation between being and non-being. Non-being is not a negation of being, but precedes being. This is the meaning of the infinite in the expression infinite freedom. The or negative sign of infinite, is not a negation, but the original excess of non-being over being that explains the difference between potentiality and actuality. This point, Kierkegaard and Aristotle are exactly the same. To say that non-being precedes being means that being, actuality, is originally imperfect or infinite. Actuality is a potential actuality, and not the actualization of potentiality, where on the contrary, what is actual determines the potential in advance. So the difference, ontologically understood, between what I'm calling the passionate self, which wouldn't make more sense to you if I hadn't read the thing on the passionate self, but the difference between what I'm calling the passionate self, the self that exceeds the objectification of the self in human capital, must be understood ontologically. The passion itself is infinite freedom. The objectified self, the self of human capital, is finite freedom. Kierkegaard wants to show ontologically that finite freedom is dependent on infinite freedom, not the other way around. Infinite freedom is not a negation of finite freedom. It's an original surplus. So just to repeat, to say that non-being precedes being means that being, actuality, is originally imperfect. To use the language of Herman Cohen, it's an originary positivity. It's originally imperfect or infinite. Actuality is a potential actuality and not the actualization of potentiality, where on the contrary, what is actual determines the potential advance. So blah blah blah, loads of interesting stuff here, but it gets even more weird, but we don't have time to do that, so note that either. Great stuff about the difference between happening and what happens. All sounds a bit like Sartre at that point. So I'm going to write to the end. Having understood Kierkegaard's ontology, and I have no idea whether you have understood it, we now know why Tronti recommended we read him again. The fundamental difference between the self in Kierkegaard and the self in human capital is that in the former, Kierkegaard, it is conceived as an infinite freedom, and in the latter, as a finite one. The difference between infinite and finite freedom is the difference in the relation between possibility and actuality. In finite freedom, actuality or necessity determines possibility. Whereas in infinite freedom, it's the other way round. Possibility determines actuality. It's thinking of an, it's what I find in Kierkegaard is an ontology where possibility determines actuality. This is extremely interesting. The determination of infinite freedom, however, is not the same as the determination of finite freedom. So just to reverse the determination, just to say possibility determines actuality, rather actuality determines possibility, to reverse that relation, it's not isomorphic. It's not the same determination. In the former, so infinite freedom, freedom is ontological, whereas in the latter, it's ontic. Possibility can only determine actuality, the infinite, the finite, because non-being exists and precedes being. Temporally speaking, this means that the past, because one of the things I had to miss out is that Kierkegaard, again you can see how Heidegger plagiarized Kierkegaard takes all these ontological distinctions and temporalizes them. Temporally speaking, this means that the past only has its significance through the repetition of an open as opposed to a closed future. In existence, Kierkegaard writes, the watchword is always forward. Thank you. Did I go way over my time? I didn't.
No, we sounded like you were perfect. Thank you. Thanks, folks. Thank you.
I think that they're more, they're not as that discussion is not as separate, although he does write to say he refers to Plato. I still, for me, they're still all in the same ballpark. I think he's using Aristotle and Plato in a certain way to think against Hegel and to think against the notion that necessity must be understood as first. That the aim of philosophy is to end up with some form of necessity, you know, some timeless universe in which everything, nothing changes, nothing moves, everything is dead in a certain sense. You know, like the block universe you have in like physics. So, so I think you're right to say that. I mean, what to me, what is originally when I was reading Kierkegaard, and the concept of anxiety, by the way, is just like God knows what you guys made of it. There's two books, The Concept of Anxiety and Six Months of Death, I just read over and over and over, and then what is he talking about? It's just unbelievable. Especially, is it the openness of Six Months of Death, where it kind of mimics a kind of weird Hegelian dialectic that's gone wrong? the self, the not-self, the other, the self, so I don't know what. Anyway, so yeah, it's a really hard text. So, but when I originally though, I thought, you know, I don't really care whether Kierkegaard got Aristotle right. Because, you know, Kierkegaard's not a scholar of Aristotle. And if he was a scholar of Aristotle, he wouldn't be Kierkegaard. He'd be some tedious, boring professor like me in a university talking about Kierkegaard to other tedious, boring people. And so, I mean, you know, he rejected that. So, but it was weird. I thought, God, I can't really remember Aristotle because I'd done it so many years ago. So I thought, oh, I'll go back and read Aristotle, you know, check that he hasn't completely made it up, and then I'll go back and read people on Aristotle. And what surprised me is that in some of the scholarly work on Kierkegaard and Aristotle, a lot of the stuff is about how he didn't really understand it, how he didn't actually read Aristotle, how he only read, is it Trendelberg or somebody? He only read these lectures on Aristotle and blah blah blah. No, I'm not a sufficient scholar of Aristotle to know whether those interpretations are right or wrong. But what I did find interesting is that Auerbach's interpretation of Aristotle, where Auerbach says, look, you cannot understand change through the difference of potentiality and actuality. You have to do it the other way around. You can only understand the difference between potentiality and actuality because Aristotle already understands being as change. Being is already in motion for him. And that's how it, you know, and we got the whole thing the wrong way around. And I thought, that's exactly what Kierkegaard's doing. Even if he misunderstood what he was reading, that's exactly what he's doing in the Philosophical Fragments. Those really dense pages at the end where he starts talking about coming into existence, necessity and all this. So the key for me is that I kind of slightly avoid the Platonism because I find Platonism a bit too static for me. Especially the ideal self sounds like a self that's somehow outside of me. Whereas for me, there, the self of Kierkegaard is the intense, passionate self. But it's not the self that's me. It's, which is that when I talk about the passionate self in terms of thinking, everything, it's the self, the passionate self, is the self that's related to the other. It's not itself. It's continually not being itself. It's always becoming, and maybe that's why I kind of resist the kind of Plato. But I do know that the footnote you're referring to, which is amazing.
Anyone else? Okay, Alison.
I'm sure this one
was. Well, I was looking.
Didn't you have your? No, you were just yawning, weren't you? Stretching. We've talked before about how an embarrassing situation when you stretch and somebody says, what? Yeah. I managed to do that in a Derrida. I managed to do it in a Derrida seminar, so it's really good.
We have got a question. It's not really a question, but when we talk about it from death, we've been studying it from death in Kierkegaard, and I sort of, to get around studying it myself, sort of basically. And I didn't realise he was just mimicking Hegel. I thought it was just how he was talking. Is he still talking about the actual self meaning or is it
Well, I do think he's putting forward a serious point.
Yes.
And, you know, what's so important about reading that, I mean, part of it I think is ironic. Myself, I don't know Kierkegaard, so I'm just reading out how I read, I mean, God knows what he's doing. But I do think part of it is, you know, part of the thing is he does appropriate dialectics. So people tend to think, oh, Hegel, Kierkegaard, they're totally different. So essentially he does appropriate. And also I would say that the Hegel of Kierkegaard is a caricature. He's not really talking about Hegel. He's talking about Hegelians. You know, and there's a lot of movement in Hegel. So I never think the image of Hegel that Kierkegaard is putting forward is a caricature in its own form. But what's at the heart of Kierkegaard, I think, to me, is how can we understand subjectivity? What does it mean to be a self? And what I think for Kierkegaard, he wants to say it's being a self. And being a self is always to be suspended in the possible. But what we tend to do is close down that movement because we only recognise ourselves in the actual. You know, so where you come and see me, someone like me, in the seminar, and at the end of it, we talk about Kierkegaard, and I say to you, "What are you going to do when you finish your degree?" And in that moment, you freeze and you think, "Well, what am I? You know, what?" That's the self we get confused. We think we're that self. But for Kierkegaard, he wants to say that the self you're not yet is actually more than the self that you are. So beyond all that kind of madness at the beginning of that sickness and death, to me that's what I see there. Well, that's for me anyway. And I want to take that, what I think is a very ontologically rich notion of human freedom, which is far more weird and mad than the platitudes of existential authenticity. I want to use that deep ontological sense of the self. I am already what I am not, and what I am not precedes what I am, to as a critique of human capital, as of all these processes of identification that we have to accomplish as self entrepreneurs.
So
thanks,
that was great. Even though I love laughing.
Yeah.
I just want to say I think it's actually really important that a number of people now really keep going. But on the other hand, it kind of slightly worries me that so many people now seem to think that Kierkegaard is the major inspiration. I mean, my collection says that even their students know that Kierkegaard, since the ultimate one is there, will see to go to Kierkegaard, and then they'll find out what the truth really is. And I also want to read Kierkegaard from that process. Thank you. true of him.
Mm. Sorry, I interrupted you. I completely agree with you totally and absolutely. I mean, I suppose if I was going to one thing I'd say right is I was being honest when I say that Kierkegaard is really difficult. So in one sense, you know, to turn to Schelling is like trying to make something really difficult explain it through something really difficult. It's just a lack of courage, at worst a lack of ability. So I mean, for me, I would just say, oh no, Aristotle is just a way in to these questions for me. I am not making the claim that the only way to understand Kierkegaard's ontology is Aristotelian. And also I'd even claim, you know, the Aristotle I'm talking about is a very kind of, you know, French Heideggerian Aristotle anyway. So I'm not making, so my argument really for me is more about that. What am I doing with Kierkegaard? I am not claiming to be a scholar of Kierkegaard. What I'm saying is, that's why I kind of did the personal stuff at the beginning, is to say, Kierkegaard, I found by struggling with Kierkegaard, trying to understand what Kierkegaard was saying, it helps me think about, well, what is another way of thinking about myself that runs counter to the discourse of the self that's so dominant in our society? And that, so it's going back to our original Chomsky quote. Say, well, you know, maybe you'll go back to read, because here there's one person, you know, but for him, for religious reasons, why he had to really think about what does it mean to be a self. I want to say there's a deep sense of self here to counter that shallow sense of self that has its effigy in that the horrific concept of human capital that dominates my every waking moment as a Chomsky teacher, where I have to say this shit to students. You know, to their parents. Well, I don't even believe it. You know, I want to say to my students, you know, do philosophy because it makes you absolutely unemployable. So that would be my because I read your stuff on Schelling and McKibb, and I think absolutely right. But I'm not claiming, it would be ridiculous for me to claim that, oh yeah, you know, the only way to understand Kierkegaard is through Aristotle, and he is just. So that's a bit of a. Yeah. I think I used that Aristotle trope though, because I thought the irony is Heidegger dismisses Kierkegaard in Being and Time as having no ontology. He's just talking about people feeling a bit sad stuff, a bit anxious, but you know, it's all object and no ontology. Is that the irony is that, you know, you could say that the reawakening of ontological difference for Heidegger is via Aristotle. So it's kind of ironic that, for me at least, one way of thinking about Kierkegaard's ontology is through Aristotle.
He doesn't like his perspective of time, I don't know. No. But also, he said somewhere that the two most interesting
philosophical works of John Constantine
Anxiety
and
the
Upper Room.
No,
it is the main philosophical work,
sorry, that
we need
to
read
in
the main philosophical work of
Constantine
Anxiety. Mm. Yeah, it is the most difficult of his, I think, Constantine Anxiety. Part of philosophical guidance as well, which is just like.
Did Kierkegaard have a girlfriend? He did, actually.
I think we were here at the beginning, that will make sense.
Never mind. He had a wife and a girlfriend.
He did, yeah.
In time.
Yeah.
Maybe this will. Maybe this will help Heidegger out in a certain way with this accusation.
Oh, I thought you were Heidegger.
No, I'm not going to say anything about Heidegger. I'm just going to. Maybe this. I don't know if this will feed into the. Point about why he said that Kierkegaard doesn't have an ontology. No, it's really an opportunity maybe for you to say something about part of the paper you didn't read, which was precisely the shift from Aristotle to Kierkegaard. Mm. In other words, you sort of said Kierkegaard takes Aristotle's ontology and applies it to the subject. Now that's what's a curious move, and one wonders if the reason Heidegger said what he said is because Kierkegaard is just talking about subject rather than beings as a whole. And my thought was this, I wonder how, I mean, this is just maybe my ignorance of both Aristotle and Kierkegaard speaking, and they're just completely genuine in this. Is Kierkegaard's vision of the subject really akin to Aristotle's vision of being? So, if in Aristotle we have an originally imperfect, incomplete totality, and that's what makes it possible for there to be change. Mm. This is very nice. But then, is that really, if you have a subject in Kierkegaard with infinite freedom,
This sounds to me like the possibility of creation, as if the subject has infinite freedom to decide, to etc., etc. It sounds like creation, and I wonder if you want to associate creation with an ancient Greek philosopher. But I think thought in a sort of a storybook history of philosophy, the concept of creation isn't there. In ancient thought, it tends to arise with it's Christianity, and so we have a I know what you mean, but I wondered if you wanted to say there was that sort of creation in the Aristotelian ontology. That's roughly my very vague question. I mean, is the Kierkegaardian subject really so akin to Aristotle's being?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole can of worms here, isn't there, that you opened.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to run now. It'd be really funny if I did. That's it.
You
just saw me running.
Really,
yeah. No, I do know. Well,
kinesism.
I can give you a Heideggerian answer to your Heideggerian question, which is that I would say that Heidegger subjectivizes being.
Okay.
So I don't really see it as a problem if you think, well, he's not doing what, blah, blah, blah. I mean, in other words, you know, if you take being and time, I know that Heidegger avoids all these words. I know quite rightly why he avoids them. He doesn't avoid words because words contain are mystical containers of things. He avoids them because they are possibilities of misunderstanding. So words in themselves are not evil for Heidegger. Just that they have baggage. So he's writing at the time of the history of Neo-Kantianism. I used to think, you know, because I'd gone through Derrida and Deleuze, oh, I can never use the word subject because it's an evil word.
Mm.
Subject, self, they're all evil. I've got to use like desiring machines or gods. You know. And then I thought, why can I not reclaim these words? Why do they have? And I remember somewhere in Being in Time or somewhere, how do you get the sense of the same thing? You know, what words are about are important, not words themselves. So I would say that it's possible to give a reading of Being in Time and say that it's subjectivized being. But because, and I think against me, Heidegger would say, well, in a certain sense, that's already an Aristotle. But that is, that being for Heidegger only has a meaning because we are the types of being that talk about being. It's because we talk about being that the chair has being. The chair is not slightly interested in being. The chair doesn't even have a being. It's not a property of a chair. It's because the chair has being because it matters to us. So in that sense, you know, in that general movement, that's what I mean. I am aware that paragraph there is moving too fast. But what I wanted to say is that the stuff about kinesis in Aristotle is in the physics. And I wanted to say that, in a certain sense, what Kierkegaard does is take that language, which is in the physics, but to talk about it in terms of what it means to be a self. There's clearly Aristotle is not doing that. So you could say that Heidegger takes Aristotle and does it in talking about the subject of self in Being in Time. He's using Aristotelian notions of possibility and actuality in Being in Time. So that's what I meant, is that Kierkegaard takes this language that's in the physics and then uses it to talk about itself.
Mm-hmm.
Now back to the other things. I do think that it's not about decisions. You know, that's my little vignette when I say to the student, what are you going to do with your life? That's, to me, that's not infinite freedom. That is, what life offers us is certain possibilities which are delimited by an actuality in advance. That's how human capital says it. It says be this or else. So it makes us feel that that life is already, that we're governed by some necessity in advance. There are no alternatives. What I find, when, you know, that famous quote that Deleuze loves. I'll never find it nowhere. Oh, here it is. Yeah. Get possibility. Get possibility. Possibility is the only salvation. No, that's from Sickness Unto Death. That's what this ontological infinite freedom is about.
Can I ask you
one more
exact point?
Yeah, go on. Yeah, this is a free for all. We're all friends.
But
yeah.
I mean,
No, he doesn't. The self of infinite freedom is infinite in the sense that it's open to the other. It goes beyond itself. But this going beyond itself is ontological. It's not, you know, me imagining myself sitting now on a beautiful Barbados beach drinking a pina colada and not sitting here in this room with you lot. It's not that imagining of possibility, which I find out. No, it's what I said, it's the best way I could do it is, and this is how I explain students in Kierkegaard, it is that you think, thinking is thinking at the limit of what is possible for you to think. And only in that moment do you actually think. So thinking contains within it not thinking, but not imagine not thinking as a possibility of thought. You know, what propels me to think is what I cannot think. But then you understanding impossibility is not something negative, but it's the very, very spur of creativity. But if you ask me to say it, I can't tell you because you're wanting me to actualize something that's infinite. But it's utterly personal. You know, my impossibility is not your impossibility.
Yeah, throw something in. We'll finish very soon, I promise. But I promise everybody. But
yeah, because you know what? You know the actuality I'm actually thinking about now. It's a pint of beer. I'm not thinking about the internet at all.
I wonder, maybe it's just a quick... I mean, I love what you did with Tronti and going back to Kierkegaard. It's just like, I'm wondering if, in the end, you really think this is going to help resist capitalism, in the sense that one could imagine that an infinite... I mean, I'm thinking of something Zizek said, actually, that the idea that what capitalism wants is an infinitely flexible self, because, in other words, you can constantly reinvent yourself and... In other words, take a sequence of temporary jobs. And I just wonder if this idea of possibility at all, even if you infinitize it, is really going to give you the kind of resistance you want. But I should imagine, if you think of your possibilities as infinite in this way, it just means you have infinite human capital. So you are infinitely profitable.
Yeah, I can see, you know, and that's why the ontology is so important.
Yeah.
That I can only say no to you because I say, oh, no, one's ontic and the other's ontological. For me that means that human capital, with all this language of authenticity, and it is expressed in that way, you know, is actually parasitical on something that it has to repress. No, that's all I'm saying is, you know, will saying that change the world? Well, of course not. I'm not claiming that. I mean, all I'm claiming is that if Tronti's last book is full of despair in the Kierkegaardian sense, because despair to me is a recognition, it's not cynicism. Despair and cynicism are not the same. Is that we can't go back to, we can't, the dialectic is not between a dead collectivity and an authentic individuality. You know, it is to me, I do think our potentiality is exhausted. I do think that. I do think that politics is finished. It is just about whether it's left or right wing. It's just simply about the economic management of society and people's possibilities. So all I could say is that if that worries you, then Kierkegaard gives you a language to think about what it might think be to think otherwise than that. But I mean, it is like, if you're going to think of it in terms of a narrative, it's many steps away from actually changing the world. That would require for us to rethink, I suppose, what a politics. I'm not really sure. Yeah, I'm not. This doesn't offer that. It just offers a way of thinking about yourself, and how could I, as a self, resist the appropriation of human capital. So it's kind of negative in that sense.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. A critique rather than anything.
Okay. Any very
final
question? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
My question would be, first of all, I will ask if Aristotle is really important for you or not, in the plan of March.
Aristotle is I don't think. Well, there's two things. One thing, Aristotelian scholarship scares the hell out of me. So in one sense you think, oh my god, that's a mountain to climb. So in that sense, I think, well, you know, I've got one life, how the hell. But beyond that kind of you know, fear, which is real, I do think it's not possible. I do, when I said that for me philosophy is about ontology, I think that's really very important for me, and I think that means for me it is not possible to do philosophy without Aristotle. But for me, Aristotle is an infinite process of interpretation.
Okay, so you're allowing me to ask my question. My of course, you know that the debate between Feynman and Obama published in 1963 Aristotle's problem with the lesson, which is a variation on Kant and the problem of metaphysics, is about the very nature of metaphysics. That is, does it have a dialectical nature or not? So what is inexhaustible, in a sense, is the ketetumene epistemen, the science of which is sought for, and which we will never actually realize. Not so much being itself. And as a matter of fact, two remarks are in order. The first point is that infinity is not a great Kant at all. And I thought I wouldn't care about what infinity when applied to being. Well, Pierre Lavanque flirts with the idea of the infinity of being. It's one of the most problematic points and most controversial of this interpretation, which is the character of the table of categories.
Yeah.
Is it open or closed? And Jacques Branch-Ding, who is the editor of Aristotle's Topics, and he was a specialist of dialectic, pointed out that you cannot the table of categories must be a closed table. There is not infinite in the meanings of being, and for the simple reason that otherwise being would be an anonymous term and a meaningless one. First point. The second one is, if I get it right, the Greek on the board, well, it would demonstrate that the entelecheia is the alpha and omega for Aristotle, because you may translate he tu nami alpha entelecheia, that is he is an article for entelecheia, which means the actuality to ontos of being dynamic by in potential being, he to yuton, he to yuton, kinesis est to yuton, such a thing is kinesis movement.
Yeah.
It's such a thing, it's a very thing.
Yeah.
So the translation is there is nothing but actuality, and movement is the being actual of what is potential. So actuality comes before and after.
Yeah, I am aware. I mean, David Webb, who's at Staffordshire University as well, who knows Greek, ancient Greek, said the same thing. But I also did do a lot of research about it, and there were many different possible readings of this. I mean, you know, translations of Aristotle are much open to dispute. And the grammar, yes, can be read. And I think, but you know, so I want to say two things to you. One thing is, actually, I've been reading Being an Event, and there's a chapter in Being an Event on Aristotle on the void, where, but just the same thing as you, there's one thing that Aristotle hates is the infinite, you know, which made me then think, oh, right, so I know that Al Benck's reading of Aristotle is very controversial. You know, so in a certain sense, if I do publish this, I think I'll have to mark that out more. Say, look, this is a very controversial reading of Aristotle, and many people would not agree with it. So in a sense, it's important to me to get Aristotle, you know, to think about what Aristotle's saying. Will any of us ever get Aristotle right? Probably not. Although I think people, if we're human species still here, will still be arguing about Aristotle because of the density of the way he writes. You know, it offers many multiple interpretations. In the end, though, I don't think, just in the sense of sense, it's not so much whether Kierkegaard's reading of Aristotle is correct or not, or whether Al Benck's reading of Aristotle is correct or not. I think what I'd have to say is, does the Al-Bakhtin reading of Aristotle, which is controversial, allow us to think of certain ways that Kierkegaard used Aristotle? Because I don't think for Kierkegaard it was important to him to get Aristotle right. He wasn't doing scholarship. You know, it was just using Aristotle to think. You know, and all I said is, when I first wrote it, that's all I did. I said we're not speaking about what the right Aristotle. It's only when subsequently I thought, oh, I'll go and look at Al Benck again. I thought, oh, this is very similar. But then now I also now realise that actually Al Benck, as you say, is taken as being a very heterogeneous reading of Aristotle. You know, in other words, you know, a lot of people don't agree with it. So I think that you're right to say that needs to be highlighted. And there was reading about you last week about the void in Aristotle. Made it clear to me that, you know, we can't really talk about the infinite in Aristotle. Not in the way that it's presented by Albert.
I'm afraid we have to talk in the bar about that.
Thank
Will for asking one.
Thank you.
I have that on record.